Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We want to welcome with us today two high school groups. These groups are with us with the Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The students across the state are asked to join us for an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, the students have been given briefs in the case and then come to oral argument. In addition to that, they meet with a justice at the end of this oral argument. They discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case we are about to hear. So we want to welcome the students. First, Menominee Falls High School. Would you please stand, please? Welcome. You may be seated. And then we have Watertown High School students. Would you all stand? It's good seeing all of you. You may be seated. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Justice Butler is the justice with whom you will meet after this oral argument. And you will be joined, I believe, by other high school students. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Robinsack. With those introductions made, I'll move on to our second case today, which is 04-AP-2035-CR, State versus Dale L. Smith. Representing Mr. Smith is Allison M. Ritter. Okay. Counsel?
Thank you, Chief Justice, and good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Allison Ritter, and I represent the petitioner, Dale Smith. The issue before the Court today is whether a current employee of a district attorney's office prosecuting a particular defendant should have been struck for cause because that individual was objectively biased as a result of that employment. This case raises the important question as to whether or not, at least in some circumstances, bias should be implied and the prospective juror excused, notwithstanding her claim of impartiality. I think that common human experience and common sense both tell us it is likely that people who work together share a certain affinity and favor for one another and could potentially be seen as biased.
Well, the jury here did not work with this particular prosecuting attorney, isn't that right?
That's correct.
And they may have been in different offices.
That's correct. I believe that they were in different buildings.
And how many assistant district attorneys are there in this office, roughly, do you know?
120.
120.
I believe that's a rough number.
Right. And how many staff people?
Probably twice that, maybe just under twice that.
So the unit, broadly speaking, is roughly 350 people.
I believe so in Milwaukee County.
Mm-hmm. And this juror did not know the prosecuting attorney.
That's correct. She indicated that she did not recognize her.
And the prosecuting attorney did not govern the juror's hiring and firing, pay scale, work conditions. Is that right?
It's not clear from the record, but I don't believe that that assistant district attorney would have power over any of those things.
Now, how does this differ? We have the Lewis case, which I think Justice Day wrote a few years ago that did not exclude I think it was a couple of police officers. And if we're not going to, and that was the case, that these are the arresting officers, this is perhaps a little further removed. This is an administrative assistant who, as the chief some of your questions implied the at least the remoteness from the actual individuals trying the case. From an objective bias, is this, are you looking that the bias would be one that a reasonable person would say that objectively we should not, or we should always be excluding people that work for the prosecutor, or what effect, if any, will this have on the Lewis case?
Justice Wilcox, I believe that the situation is not analogous to Lewis in the sense that law enforcement personnel and prosecutorial employees are two distinct classes of persons. The police department and the district attorney's office are totally separate agencies. The district attorney does not control the hiring, firing, or assignment of police officers. Occasionally, and quite recently in Milwaukee County, the district attorney has conducted numerous prosecutions of police officers. Jurisdictions which allow police officers to serve as jurors that were cited, I believe, in my response brief included Georgia, in which even though police officers were not per se excluded, district attorney employees were from serving on juries. I believe that Lewis pushed the envelope as far as it should go. Lewis didn't prohibit the use of per se exclusions based on implied bias in appropriate circumstances. State versus Getch, I believe clearly there was such a per se exclusion found in Getch, where the court found objective bias based on a specific familial relationship. I think that this case is much more closely analogous to that situation, where there is a specific relationship, an employer-employee relationship, which is much like a familial relationship. It is fraught with the possibility of bias.
Well, don't you go through, when you go through this, there are what we call general questions that are asked of the juror and the voir dire. And I can see where you could single out, and if there had been an answer different than there was, but it is, my concern is when we exclude a class of people because of their employment, and I because they may be involved in the quote justice system on one side or the other, it would seem that at least here. And maybe there's a very good reason, but I could not ascertain that reason from the questions that were asked and answered. As far as, so this is because she was an employee. That's a simple answer.
That's correct. That's correct. And I believe that the trial court is under a specific obligation, as I believe Chief Justice Abrahamson indicated in her concurrence in Lewis, to conduct a rigorous examination of the potential juror to ensure that any existing relationship doesn't interfere with their duty to view the evidence impartially. I do believe that the employment relationship is one between a juror and a party or an attorney, is one such situation where these special problems can exist, such that a circuit court's search for actual bias is inadequate to protect a defendant's right to an impartial juror.
Well, Ms. Ritter, weren't there a number of questions asked here of this prospective juror that would seem to indicate that she could be impartial? Wasn't that her response in regard to these questions?
Yes, Justice Crooks. It is my understanding that there were actually a pretty limited number of questions. The state asked the potential juror, Charlotte T., and I believe I'm quoting, that because our office is prosecuting this case, do you think you would have a problem being impartial? I think that that speaks to the relationship between the juror and the prosecuting attorney trying
the
case.
What was her response to that question?
She indicated that she could be impartial. She did state, yes, I believe I could be impartial.
And as the Chief Justice, I think, pointed out earlier, this was a woman who worked for the district attorney's office, but worked in a building several miles from where the district attorney's office is generally located. In other words, out at the Children's Center. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And she didn't even know the prosecuting attorney, knew nothing about this case. Aren't all of those things correct?
Those are all correct facts. And, in fact, those facts are are very closely related to the facts in the case U.S. versus Polichemi, which I don't believe there's any meaningful distinction between this case and Polichemi. Recognizing that the authority of the Seventh Circuit is persuasive and certainly not binding on this Court, I would ask the Court to look at that very analogous situation where, like Mr. Smith, the Polichemi defendants made a number of requests to have jurors struck for cause, including a juror who was secretary in a different division of the same U.S. Attorney's office that was trying him for the crime.
But wasn't that in Polichemi there was the close relationship? In other words, the juror had had a close relationship with the prosecutor for 15 years, and as Justice Crooks just asked, here, as I understand, there was not that. They worked in a different building. She had no knowledge of the person who was trying the case. So isn't that a distinguishable fact, at least?
No, there is no indication in the text of the Polichemi, of either Polichemi decision, indicating a close relationship. There, I believe, is nothing in either decision to support the State's factual assertion in their brief that Ms. Naip, the juror in question in that case, had a close relationship with the prosecuting attorneys.
Well, I call your attention to page in the Polichemi case, is that, let me see, if I'm trying to find it here now that I had it on the tip of my tongue, but that was my understanding that there was a factual distinction between the relationship. If I'm wrong, you can call my attention to it, but that, you're saying that there was the distance there as we have in this case?
Well, the first opinion of Polichemi merely states that Ms. Naip was a 15-year employee of that office and worked in the civil division. She admitted to recognizing the names of the prosecuting attorneys in the case.
Yeah, and I thought it was it came from the same office where the prosecuting attorneys came from. I guess that's what I was saying.
That's correct.
Different than in this case.
In this case, they come from the same office, Justice, the District Attorney's Office of Milwaukee County.
Everybody's employed by the Milwaukee County District Attorney. She's employed in the Children's Court area.
Correct.
Different matter.
That's all I'm saying.
And in the case in the Seventh Circuit, I gather one is in the Civil Division and the prosecution was Criminal Division, but they're all part of the same U.S. Attorney's Office.
That's correct.
And I don't know how many people were in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago, but my assumption is a lot.
I would surmise that as well.
As I saw that she recognized, but I'm just looking at the case on, this is page 3, that she recognized the names, admitted to recognize the name of the prosecuting attorneys in the case and being aware that they worked in her office. So maybe I'm putting a spin on this, but I gathered because of the distance and not recognizing that would be a difference as far as the closeness in one case versus the other.
I don't believe, because the distinction is that there is this recognition of their names, I think it's fair to imply that she didn't know them personally, and there was not this close personal relationship, which leads me to the conclusion that this case is very similar to the facts at issue in Mr. Smith's case, where the attorney and the administrative assistant from Children's Court didn't know each other. The fact remains that it was their office, in the prosecutor's own words. Does it bother you that our office is prosecuting this case?
So in your opinion, it makes no difference, and I'm trying to say I was a judge up in central Wisconsin, and the prosecuting office there was a prosecutor when I was there and a administrative assistant. Now, obviously, this is Milwaukee. There are hundreds of people involved, and does that make any difference, or you'd have the same answer for both situations?
We have the same answer for both situations. I think Milwaukee is in a unique position in the state of Wisconsin in that it would involve somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 people, the class of persons that this case would affect, but that's in a jurisdiction with approximately 1 million people. In the vast majority of counties in the state of Wisconsin, we're talking about a very small group of people that would be affected by such a rule. I'm asking the court to adopt a law firm rule. An analogy to a law firm. It's very limited in scope. For instance, if Havish, Havish, and Rotier were in their Madison office engaged to prosecute some action, and they were trying that matter in Appleton, and a secretary from their Appleton office was on the jury panel. I think that that administrative assistant from that firm's Appleton office would certainly be excused.
I'm not sure that's the right analogy. Why don't you try a firm that has several hundred lawyers?
Fully.
And has offices across the state, and you've got a secretary from Rhinelander in the law firm and doesn't know anybody from the Milwaukee office of this law firm.
I believe that that was the analogy, I apologize, that I was trying to
make. I'm just enlarging it to a large number, which I think makes a difference.
I do. I think that that the secretary in either situation is going to have some affinity to the members of her own office. There would be some issue of, particularly though in criminal cases, involving members of a DA staff. There are special prosecutors that are brought in from the outside when somebody from the DA's office is involved as a victim or perhaps as a witness in a criminal case. I think this prophylactic measure of excluding members of the DA's office or members of a law firm or secretaries of a law firm, employees of a firm or a party, would protect the integrity of the process.
Or employees of a company. In other words, if we apply your standard, it's going to, as the Chief Justice indicated, you're talking about both in civil and in criminal. Let's say we just keep this in the criminal area, but it could be a vast number of people would then be excluded from jury duty because of who they worked for, even though they had no knowledge of the case, even though they didn't know anything about it, except that it was their employment that would automatically for cause disqualify them. That seems to run counter to inclusion of having everybody. In fact, I shouldn't mention this, but I think President Bush was going to be called for jury duty, and I know that members of this court have been called for jury duty and have served. Now, maybe that's a different situation, but this would, if we were to adopt your position, which may be very valid, I think that this would open up where if a person worked for an entity that was involved they weren't involved, they were, let's say someone was prosecuting or one of the attorneys, you say the law firm rule, so that means that you'd have a large number of people that would be excluded from jury duty just because of who they worked for, regardless of any answer they gave that they could be fair and impartial.
That's correct, but I don't think that the danger is as extreme. I think that this class of potential jurors to be excluded is frankly fairly narrow, as I've indicated, except for in situations like Milwaukee County where you have a few hundred individuals involved. I believe that the U.S. Supreme Court has only rejected broad categories of exclusion. In Wood, the 1936 case cited in the brief, the court rejected that sweeping proposition of excluding government employees. The employees that were netted into the exclusion with respect to Wood had to do with Civil War pensioners, people that worked at the post office, people that worked at the Navy Yard. We're not talking about a broad category of government employees. I know that Wood cited Block, the court, in citing Block, the Indiana case, the court observed that the person who was a deputy prosecuting attorney was an employee and a subordinate of the prosecuting attorney.
Ms. Ritter?
Yes?
Let me ask you a little bit about this law firm rule, because I just want to get a handle on this. 80508, I want to start there with the example of statutory bias. The court shall examine on oath each person who was called as a juror to discover whether the juror is related by blood, marriage, or adoption to any attorney appearing in the case. If the juror is not indifferent in the case, the juror shall be excused. I think based upon that language, most people would tend to agree that then the attorney handling the case could not serve on the jury. What type of bias would that be an example of?
Well, the statutory bias.
The attorney, not the relationship to the attorney. The attorney, his or herself, is that an example of objective bias?
I believe that the attorney is advocating one side or the other would be an example of actual bias.
Of actual bias? Under the statute?
In other words, statutory bias? You see what I'm trying to get at?
It was my understanding that there were basically three levels of bias: statutory bias, actual bias, and then objective bias.
There's subjective, objective, and statutory, as I understand it, under Lindell.
You're equating actual with subjective. Mm-hmm. Aren't you?
Yes, yes. I'm sorry.
Okay. This would be an example of subjective bias.
Then. Correct.
All right. Now you have an employee of the attorney who is serving on the jury. As I understand your argument, and correct me if I'm wrong, essentially what you're saying is that the prosecuting attorney is not supposed to be sitting on this jury. This is an individual who serves under the prosecuting attorney. Therefore, it's the same thing. Is that essentially your argument?
That is, I believe that that's one way you can look at it. I believe that you can also look at it as, even if that person doesn't feel that they would be bias could be imputed to them, because it's not their state of mind, that individual juror, but rather whether or not a reasonable person in that juror's position would be impartial.
That shifts us to objective. But you don't have to. Witness stands up and says, oh, it's my brother. Long personal relationship with him. I picked the wrong one because that might be an automatic disqualification. Long-time friend and neighbor. Took care of my children over the years. Doesn't bother me. I can be absolutely impartial. I can be neutral. If I think she's guilty, I'm going to find that. You don't have to accept my word that I'm impartial.
That's correct.
Just because I say I am, that doesn't mean I'm subjectively impartial. I mean, you can say that's just incredible as a matter of law, you are subjectively impartial. Or if you don't like that, you can move into objective, reasonable people won't.
That's correct. And I believe that the trial judge's situation really only considered subjective bias. Objective bias was not considered. I believe that this encompasses an extreme situation, as discussed.
I want to raise a question with you. What rule of law do you want to come out of this case? Do you want the rule of law to be that no employee of the prosecutor's office prosecuting the case can serve on the juror?
Yes.
That would include, and I'm pushing on this, the janitorial maintenance staff, assuming they're employed by the prosecutor's office, which they probably are not. They're probably employed by the county. You're not moving into all county employees.
No, not at all. I offer no comment on associations more broad than the one at issue in this case, of a juror being an employee of the office prosecuting the action at the time of the trial. I'm not offering a comment with respect to former or past employees of the district attorney's office, nor prospective employees of the district attorney's office. I think a current employee in whatever county is prosecuting the case should be found to be impliedly biased or objectively biased.
And Ms. Ritter, if I can finish my question, the one thing that I'm trying to pull out of here, the concept of implied bias, do you see that concept as only being applied to objective bias, or does that also go to subjective bias?
I believe the way that I looked at it, it was only going to objective bias.
If you push it into subjective, it's just a polite way of saying that you don't believe the witness. It's incredible as a matter of law.
And I believe that this is an extreme situation that was described by Justice O'Connor in her concurrence in Phillips. I think that it requires the trial court, as Chief Justice Abrahamson indicated in Lewis, to go beyond that simple finding of no bias. Just because the person says no bias, the court has to, the inquiry can't end there. It's inadequate to uncover objective bias that the law can conclusively presume in situations that are extreme like this.
Counsel, in your brief, you start out discussing other jurors in the case. Why did you do that?
The other jurors in the case, I thought, were...
potential jurors, I should say.
The other potential jurors in the case. I felt more important to show that Mr. Smith was facing, there has been this argument having to do with that the defense will somehow use this implied bias exclusion to their advantage by leaving jurors on a panel like Charlotte T. in order to have some kind of ace up their sleeve for appeal. And frankly, I believe that argument flies in the face of reason. Justice Woods in Palachemi, or Judge Woods, I apologize, in Palachemi indicates that she suspected that prudent counsel is going to continue to use peremptory challenges in order to safeguard their client rather than gambling anything for appeal later on. The situation with respect to the other jurors shows what Mr. Smith was facing. He was facing a number of other jurors, one who had arrested individuals for OWI and could potentially offer information to the jury about how police officers conduct business generally and what certain tests mean and that sort of thing in the jury room. The other three jurors that were excluded all indicated at one point or another during questioning that they favored the other side or disfavored Mr. Smith. And he didn't have any other choice in this situation. I think that any defense counsel would have struck the individuals who at one point or another indicated actual bias against their client.
Counselor, was there ever any assignment of overflow work from the criminal prosecution divisions to the children's division?
There's no indication of that in my own experience. I can tell you that assistant district attorneys from downtown are routinely assigned out to children's court for periods of time and then brought back downtown.
Okay, but in this record, you don't know of any, nothing's in the record about that?
No.
Thank you. The assumption we make is that she did not know this prosecuting attorney.
That's correct.
Could you, from your experience, do you know whether the assistant district attorneys out in children's court ever prosecute traffic cases involving juveniles?
I don't. Yeah, I believe that they would prosecute, for instance, OWI cases in juvenile court.
Certain of that?
I'm not certain of it, no. But I believe they would. I think that that's where jurisdiction would lie for an OWI second, for instance, or a criminal action involving a juvenile.
Let me ask one other question. When this court reformulated the different categories of juror bias, do you think the test for objective bias is any different from the test for implied bias formerly?
I don't, particularly in this case where the facts are not at issue. It is simply a question of law, I think, for the court to decide. So I don't think it's very different.
I thought, but I don't have the case in front of me, that there's a line in that case that says change the terminology but not really the tests. That was my recollection from that case. I just don't have it in front of me.
The Faucher case?
Pardon me? In the case that changed terminology from subjective and objective to from actual, et cetera. I thought there was a line in that case.
Chief Justice, my time has expired.
Aren't you pleased? You may be seated. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal, Ms. Ritter. Mr. Colas. Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Haven't seen you for a while, Mr. Colas.
Good afternoon. Good morning. May it please the court. In this case, the burden is on Mr. Smith to show that the trial court in this case committed a manifest error, that no reasonable judge in this trial court's position could have reached the conclusion that this juror was not objectively biased. And in that, Mr. Smith has failed, and the court should affirm
the judgment of the Court of Appeals as well as the decision of the trial court. On the facts in this case, the controlling authority is clearly State versus Lewis. The facts in this case present a situation in which the juror did not know the attorney, was not under supervision of the attorney, had never worked with the attorney, did no investigations into this kind of case.
Mr. Colas, isn't Lewis a different situation in that in Lewis we're talking about a police officer who doesn't work for the district attorney's office, and in this case we're talking about a secretary that does?
There are differences between this case and Lewis, but the differences actually favor the State. It is true that in Lewis the relationship that was involved was between police officers on the jury and police officers as witnesses and at counsel table as the chief investigator. The relationship between a juror and a witness is much more central to the jury's function than the relationship between a juror and a prosecutor or an attorney for the defense. The jury's primary role is assessing the credibility and weight to be given to the evidence in front of it as presented through the witnesses that are before it. So in the Lewis case, the relationship between the juror and the witness that creates the potential bias is much more central to the impartiality of the trial process than is the relationship in this case.
As I understand Ms. Ritter's argument, though, essentially it's saying that by having the employee of the district attorney on the jury is the same thing as having the district attorney on the jury. It's one office, one law firm, it's the same thing. It's one step different than having someone who's removed from the office serving on the jury.
I think that's precisely the kind of argument that has been rejected because it severs the determination of implied bias from the particular facts and circumstances of the case before the trial court. And the decisions are clear that a finding of implied bias has to be rooted in those facts and circumstances. Where the facts and circumstances that are posited are so broad that they encompass any one of 350 people who may have no relationship at all to one another except common employment, then it is too broad a category, and it's the kind of category that's been rejected. In the Smith versus Phillips case in the U.S. Supreme Court, the concurrence in which is often cited, the actual fact of the case is that the Supreme Court found that a juror who sought employment with the prosecutor's office during the trial did not have a sufficient relationship with the attorney to find implied bias. That's why it's important to go to the particular facts of the case. In a smaller county, it may well be that there would be implied bias looking at the particular facts. In Polichemi, the court looked at the particular facts, a 15-year employee working in the same office, not as here in two distinct offices, in a different division, but a division that often took assignments from the criminal division, and where the secretary recognized the attorneys. That's the kind of factual analysis that needs to be done in these cases. That's why the decisions all the way through, from Lewis through Falker and Lindell, give deference to the trial court in these cases. It is not a question of law that's reviewed de novo by the appeals courts. There is deference given to the trial court and the trial court's determination in these cases.
Mr. Colas, suppose juror number 9 had been employed in the office downtown and had only been there 3 months. Didn't know this particular prosecutor. Would you be making the same argument?
I think in that situation, one would need to know additional facts. Had she I guess in the hypothetical Your Honor poses, she did not know the assistant district attorney. One might want to know, did she work in the same unit, for instance, the domestic violence unit or the felony crimes unit, or did she work in a separate unit?
Separate unit.
If we suppose that it was a separate unit, it may not be implied bias even in that situation.
When is it that you would find objective bias or implied bias when someone works in the same office?
I think the clearest case would be one in which the secretary had an actual working day-to-day relationship with the prosecutor. If my secretary were to appear as a juror in one of my cases, I think that would clearly be a case of implied bias. I think as you move away from that, it becomes more remote. Perhaps another secretary in the criminal litigation unit in our department would also be impliedly biased. If you extend it to the Department of Justice, a secretary who works for the crime laboratory in Wausau, who I have never met and has never worked on one of my cases or had anything to do, even with our unit, I think would not, even though she works for the same employer, the Wisconsin Department of Justice. So I think that is why such deference is given to the trial court, because it is very fact-dependent. Even though it's not subjective bias, the finding has to very much be rooted in the particular facts and circumstances.
Is it one of the concerns that happens that when you have a person who has knowledge of the inner workings of the prosecutor's office, questions can come up in the jury room as part of the deliberations that say, okay, well, what does the DA normally do in this setting? How is this handled in the office? Now, this particular individual wouldn't have any specific knowledge necessarily of these particular facts or circumstances, but in getting that type of question and giving that type of answer, doesn't that bring the potential for taint into the jury room?
I think no more than in Lewis, having police officers who are familiar with investigative techniques and with how cases are reviewed in the district attorney's office would taint the jury, no more than an employee of an insurance company who would know how claims are handled should be disqualified from serving on an insurance case. So, yes, jurors bring all kinds of knowledge, and in the instructions they are cautioned about how to apply that knowledge.
I think I'd be more concerned about the employee of the insurance company whose case is handled in that court. If they bring that type of knowledge, that I think would frighten me.
This court has not found that employees of litigants are disqualified from service on the jury. And nor should it. It should depend on the facts and circumstances. There's a strong presumption in Wisconsin law and tradition of broad service on juries and of the importance of a diversity of perspectives brought into play in the process.
Also, I asked your opposing counsel a similar question about if we were to accept her argument, what effect this would have on the jury pool, not just in the prosecuting attorney's office, but you sort of answered or implied, and I'm not talking about the Department of Justice, but the insurance industry or any employee-employer relationship, which are vast. My concern is, this could be applied to many different situations if we had a bright line or, you know, a blanket rule here or whatever you want to call it. Do you see that also, or is that, do you think I'm being too concerned about what we would do if we were to come down and just say absolutely can't sit, rather than individualizing?
I think that is a valid concern. It's the concern that was expressed in the concurrence in State versus Lewis. Although the immediate ruling in the case would be something like, if granted as requested by Mr. Smith, the ruling would be something like no employees of prosecutors' offices may serve on juries. That is a per se classification and will immediately become precedent for advancing other per se classifications.
Mr. Cole, maybe I don't mean to nitpick, but I don't think that's what Ms. Ritter is asking for. I think her request is that no person employed in a prosecutor's office can sit on a jury that is handled by that prosecutor's office. Not that they can't sit on a jury. in general.
No, I didn't ask.
And I understand you didn't, but I was responding to your answer. I think that's a little bit broader than what she was arguing for.
Your Honor is correct. I did overstate the rule that she seeks.
Mr. Colas, your opposing counsel talked about these other potential jurors and painted rather graphically who they were. I didn't sense that you wanted to deal with that subject in your brief.
With the question of...
Does it make any difference? Was this just a diversion, a red flag, a red herring?
I don't think in this case... I don't think it makes any difference on the question of whether implied bias should be found or not, what the other jurors were. What we can tell from the jury strikes in this case, the defense exercised 4 peremptory strikes. 2 of those were exercised against jurors whom he had challenged for cause. The other 2 were jurors that had not been challenged for cause. What can be inferred from that is that, at least in the mind of this trial counselor, the possibility of bias from this employee of the district attorney's office was 5th or worse or lower on his list of concerns about the fairness of this jury. And he had greater concerns about others, including others whom he had not challenged for cause, and others whose challenge for cause or whose denial of exclusion for cause is not in dispute here and must be presumed to have been correct judgments by the trial court. So
did the counsel challenge for cause the police officer?
I believe he challenged for cause the police officer who was juror number 3. And he also challenged for cause juror number 6, who had expressed some very strong opinions about drunk driving cases.
Mr. Colas, I'm hoping I'm not misreading the record then, because when I went through and looked at the transcript of this proceeding, and correct me if I'm wrong, I thought there were actually 3 strikes for cause by defense counsel, 1 for juror 2, 1 for juror... Strike that. 4 strikes for cause. 1 for juror 2, 1 for juror 9, 1 for juror 6, 1 for juror 11. And then the defense counsel used peremptories on 2, 6, 3, and 11, if I understood correctly. And did not use a peremptory for juror number 3, but I don't think he moved for cause on juror 3 either. Am I misreading the record?
He did use a peremptory on juror 3.
But he didn't move to strike for cause on 3. Am I misreading that?
That was a police officer.
Right.
You're correct.
Thank you,
Your Honor. He did not.
I'm
not sure whether he moved to strike for cause on juror 2 or not. He didn't actually explicitly ask the court to strike for cause. The transcript reads... this is the whole statement made about juror number 2. I think number 2 said he couldn't be impartial. I asked him again, and he said he could be impartial. I did not interpret that as requesting the court to strike for cause.
Thank you.
Let me ask this. Suppose you had a nephew who was arrested for drunk driving. And that nephew had as a potential juror someone who was working for the prosecutor's office that was prosecuting the case. What would you advise your nephew?
I think that I would advise him that the juror is not objectively biased. As a tactical matter, taking into account the whole composition of the jury panel, he may wish to strike that juror and use his peremptories in a tactical fashion. Trial attorneys make those kinds of judgments all the time, in trying to winnow the jury panel, sometimes for sound reasons, sometimes because you have four strikes and you've got to use them up.
Counsel, the Porcheni case answers that Justice Prosser's question in this fashion. Indeed, the risk of implied objective bias lies behind many of the rules that require excusing a juror for cause. A court must excuse a juror for cause if the juror is related to one of the parties in the case or if the juror has a financial interest in the case. It is possible, of course, that a particular juror may be quite capable of maintaining her objectivity, even if her nephew is a lawyer in the case. But the relationship is so close that the law errs on the side of caution. So I read that as saying even if we didn't in Wisconsin have this relationship as a statutory basis, that it's just so close. Even if the aunt and nephew relationship, one says, well, look, you know, I can sit as a fair and impartial juror. I don't care that my relative is prosecuting this. The court says, no. And if it's in doubt, we err on the side of caution.
I think in a case with different facts, that erring on the side of caution might produce a different result. But in a case with the facts that we're facing, where the proposal is that any employee of a district attorney's office be barred from serving on a criminal jury in that county, the facts don't support the finding that a reasonable person in that position can't be impartial.
Well, let me see if the Foucher case responds to you. On page 74, citing the Gesch case, the court said, we said, that some relationships are so fraught with the possibility of bias that we must find objective bias regardless of the surrounding facts and circumstances and the particular juror's assurance of impartiality. So we were saying there, as it seems to me, that you know, you keep on talking about, well, what about the facts, the specific facts? And yet, and of course, Foucher also goes on to say, now you look at the facts separately, and yet there seems to be this language also in Foucher that says, look, we don't care about, now I'm paraphrasing, we don't care about the individual surrounding facts and circumstances because there are some relationships that are so fraught with the possibility of bias that we must find objective bias, regardless of the facts and regardless of the assurances of impartiality. Why isn't this one of those? And if it's close, why don't we err on the side of caution?
I think in the Foucher case, the court actually did look at the facts, notwithstanding that statement, and based its ruling on the facts in that case, that the particular statements made by the potential juror in that case that the witness, who was his next-door neighbor, would not lie and that he had no doubt about his integrity. The court in Foucher specifically said that a court might be reversed if the juror had been stricken based solely on the fact of a relationship barring all next-door neighbors. So even though that language is in Foucher, in fact, there's other language to the contrary and the conclusion of the decision itself, which is that facts do matter in finding implied bias, that we don't create per se categories, broad categories of people who we exclude from jury duty. And I think on the facts in this case, it's simply too remote a relationship. Had this case come before the court with a much closer relationship within a prosecutor's office, it might be a different case.
Did our terminology change the substantive law?
In my reading of the cases, it did not. The change in terminology was just a change in terminology. It was not intended to change the law. And, in fact, didn't change the law.
You withdrew from your brief the argument that even if this had been error and that this juror should have been removed for cause, that it was harmless error. I assume from the withdrawal of that language that your position is if the juror should have been removed for good cause, new trial is required.
That's correct.
Because by definition, it can't be harmless error when you have a juror that should have been removed. Now, another juror might very well have come to the same conclusion because of the weight of the evidence, but you have to that's not a fair trial.
I believe under the Gash case, in these circumstances, reversal is the proper remedy if it's found that the trial court and the court of appeals were in error.
Any effect of Ramos and its subsequent case on this case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't think that either Ramos or Lindell affected the substantive law that's applicable in this
right,
case.
Because in both of those cases, the juror was removed.
That's correct.
The only problem was that you limited defense as to, excuse me, number of strikes.
That's correct.
Okay.
In conclusion, pardon me? Okay,
good. I was going to lead you into your conclusion by saying anything more you want to tell us, Mr. Goldens.
I think that if the court finds in favor of Mr. Smith in this situation, it really is creating significant new law in Wisconsin that would be an effective reversal of the Lewis case and of other decisions in civil cases in which employees of litigants were found not to be implied bias. It would also be setting out on new ground in Wisconsin. It would, in effect, alter Wisconsin's legal tradition and existing case law and statutory law of opening jury service to as broad a sector of the community and of the public as possible. And most importantly, on the facts in this case, it simply can't be said that no reasonable judge would find this juror to have been unbiased.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, and I did find the language about the terminology. It's in paragraph 5 of the Foucher case. It says, our adoption of these new terms does not, however, change our existing jurisprudence. You agree with that?
I agree with that.
Thank you. Ms. Ritter?
Thank you again. I believe that Justice Marshall, almost 200 years ago, when he indicated his concern in situations where an individual and their impartiality would be in question, I believe that that's being echoed by Justice Bradley's concern. I submit that being an administrative assistant in the prosecutor's office is such a connection that would induce suspicion that Justice Marshall was concerned about. That relationship might be remote. That person might not ever even have seen the party, Justice Marshall indicated, like Charlotte T. had never met the district attorney trying the case. But they both worked for Mr. McCann, and they were both servants of his. That individual may declare that he or she feels no prejudice in the case, as Charlotte T. did, and yet the law cautiously incapacitates that person from serving on the jury because it suspects prejudice, because in general persons in similar situations would feel prejudice. This is exactly the type of situation that was warned of in Getch and Foucher, and this is one of those close cases, those extreme situations, I believe, that Justice O'Connor warned of in her concurrence.
So in the balance of the situation when, if we were to rule, to say that we would rule against you, or I think my example would be if we ruled for you, then the person that would be put on the jury, this would really give you a for cause, and then you would have, you know, your four preempts. And I was going to just ask, you feel it's unfair to force you to use your preemptory challenge, correct? In other words, you want an automatic for cause where this person is off.
That's correct. I think that the court should find that that juror is biased as a matter of law.
It's only in this narrow situation, prosecutor's office?
That's correct.
How do we not extend that? Do we just say we do not, if we adopt this, we do not extend this any further?
By analogy, I believe
that... You've got a lot of offices where, you know, as the opposing counsel indicated, in the civil situation or even in the criminal situation, there could be working with the police officer, working in the police station, things of that nature.
That's correct, and I offer no comment on associations more broad than the one at issue in this case with respect to the juror being an employee of the office that is bringing the action against him or her at the time of the trial.
But your analogy was to a law firm.
Yeah.
So one would assume it would cover that. I assume if a police officer were on trial that an employee of that police department, not any old police department, might be knocked out.
That's possible.
Well, on the objective test, you're suggesting it is.
It is. With respect to the police officer being the defendant in a case, whether or not the state would move to strike for cause, police officers on the panel as they are in the same
department.
Police department as that individual.
Mm-hmm. So in the, I think the argument here, as I see it, is doing it on a case-by-case or doing it with a rather broad perspective, a bright line. And it would make a difference, I think, if it's tried in, I hate to always use this, but up in Washera County where there are fewer people than in Milwaukee when you have a police department. This is what the chief is at. You have a police department of some 2,000 officers, I believe, and plus I don't know how many supporting cast. So this would take them out of it also.
I do believe that a bright line rule would guide courts and parties. The court and the parties in this case, frankly, were all looking for that guidance. Quite literally, they were asking for it in chambers when discussing the possible striking of Charlotte T. And I think that that would serve Wisconsin well in this situation.
Counselor, opposing counsel suggests that if there were a witness who was an employee of the DA's office, that would be a much stronger case for you because the role of the jury is to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses, and so therefore Charlotte T's connection would be more central to the purposes that a jury sits in a trial. Do you agree that would be a stronger case if we were looking at a witness they had to evaluate?
And I'm out of time. May I?
Yes.
Thank you. Justice Rogenstein, I think that example is basically the fact situation in Lewis where police officers are called as witnesses for the prosecution, and this court appropriately found that a blanket exclusion with respect to that situation is inappropriate. Whether or not a juror sits on a case, is employed by the same firm or the same office or the same corporation as a witness in a case, frankly, I think is beyond the facts of this situation.
Yes.
Where we have an actual attorney or party relationship. And I don't offer a comment with respect to that.
I don't agree with his contention that if it were a witness, it would be a stronger case than you refer to Lewis.
Correct.
Thank you. That was just my question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ritter.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Colas, for your arguments today on another case involving allegations of juror bias. That concludes our hearing in 04-AP-2035-CR, State versus Dale Smith. The court is in recess until 1:30 when I will hear its third case for the day. Those students who are remaining to discuss procedures with Justice Butler should stay here. They may be joined by other students shortly. We are in recess until 1:30.